This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. San Antonio is in flash flood alley. There are storms that hit here that deliver more water than we can handle. In recent memory, there was the 2002 flood when we got 16 inches of rain and flooded many parts of the city. And in 1998, there was a flood that took the lives of 25 people. Since then, there have been flood control projects, but also continued growth and development in climate change. So we're getting bigger and badder storms. Just think what would have happened if Harvey had come to San Antonio. We're talking about getting ready for the next big rain event in San Antonio. What questions or comments do you have? Are you thinking about getting flood insurance? Should you? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. And you can tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by City Council Member Manny Pelaez. He is the council representative from District 8. Nefi Garza, he is the Assistant Director of the City of San Antonio's Transportation and Capital Improvements Department. Stephen Graham is the Assistant General Manager for the San Antonio River Authority. And Emily Royal is the Data Director for the Rivard Report. Welcome, all of you. It's great to have you here.
Hey, David.
Thanks, David.
Well, Stephen Graham, let me ask you, what could we have had in San Antonio if Harvey had continued on that forecasted path?
Well, yeah, we all saw that another 50 to 60 miles further west, and we would have been in the bullseye ourselves here in San Antonio. Let me say, if you get 50 inches of rain, you're going to be swamped, and things would have been very bad here as well.
Would have been 50?
Well, 50 inches was the epicenter that they got in Houston. The average was in the 40s and 30s, but they did have the maximum record for Texas, 51 inches in 5 days. It even exceeded what we had from Amelia in 1978, which was 48 inches. So that's the new North American record for a tropical storm.
But even if we had just gotten half of that, it would have been catastrophic?
Absolutely. Nephi can talk to this more, but our 100-year flood control structures are designed for about 10 inches of rain in 24 hours. So you have to draw the line somewhere. What can we afford to mitigate for on the governmental side? But then we have to say, what can we do preventative? What can people do to understand their risk? What can they do to minimize, get insurance, do things with their own property? How can we develop differently? The full resiliency spectrum of things is how do we plan ahead, how do we mitigate, and how do we make sure we have the proper infrastructure. But we cannot build our way out of this problem. But even the proper building and planning would not have avoided some flooding there. So that's where we have to speak about what do we do during and after a storm, as well as plan ahead of a storm.
Still, I'm going to explore this parallel universe where Harvey came to San Antonio, and if we had gotten 25 inches of rain, we would have been Canoe City?
Well, it would have been different. Houston's flooding is like a big bathtub where it doesn't drain. So water goes, it sits, and it drains slowly. Here we're on Flash Flood Alley, where the hill country comes to basically the 35 corridor in the coastal flats, and that fast water slows down and spreads out. So what we have in terms of flooding in San Antonio is it rises faster and higher, but then it runs out quicker. So we don't have the standing water. So we have quick devastation. We have flash flooding at road crossings. A lot of our deaths and fatalities are due to low water crossings and people going in, and that water's only at their tires, and within a minute, it's going into their doors.
Nefi Garza, where would that have hurt San Antonio the worst? What parts of the city were impacted?
David, as I was preparing for this, I thought a lot about the storm, this hypothetical parallel universe that you're talking about. And I think that we would have to look at the past of how we have reacted in the past. In 2002, we had a significant storm event hit us, but it didn't hit us all at once. It hit us in bands. So it would rain one in the morning and then again in the afternoon. But that caused so much damage in our area. But if you compare that to the damage that we received in 98, there were some significant improvements to our drainage infrastructure in that time. So thinking about this event, many of the projects that have been constructed, many of the awareness that the public is aware of, I think we would have gotten flooded quite pretty bad. But I think we would have fared pretty well. One of my coworkers, she was preparing to leave in preparation for the event, and she told me that she was driving home up 281 and 1604, and on her way, she probably saw two or three cars. People heard the message, and they stayed home. Of course, this happened on a Friday. So I think people's awareness, I think the infrastructure that has been would certainly contribute to help.
Manny Pelaez, City Council Representative for District 8. Did you get a briefing on what was happening, Harvey coming to San Antonio?
Oh, we got many. We'd get constant updates throughout the day and night from your organization, Sarah, and from Nephi and his team, from SAPD and Fire. You know, the challenge wasn't getting updates. The challenge was what's going to happen next, right? I mean, every minute we had different situations that and different permutations of potential disaster going through everybody's head. And so I commend city staff and all of our first responders and all of our partner agencies for staying on top of it. Nonetheless, I am chilled to the bone at the thought of what could have happened had this storm decided to take a left instead of taking a right and go to Houston. And so the conversation that we're having today is certainly important, David, but you know, it's a conversation that we need to have every day of every year going forward, because these weather events are the new normal.
And Emily Royal, looking at your data, you're the data director for the Rivard Report. If San Antonio had gotten that much rain, 25 inches of rain, half of what they got in Houston, would it have overwhelmed the systems that we have in place now?
Well, David, you know, here at the Rivard Report, our role is really to take the data sources that are out there and combine them into stories that the public can understand and to tools that the public can use to understand their situation better. And I think that's a good question, but I'm not sure if the data out there really tells us what would happen in the event of a 500-year storm like what Houston had. Instead, it really tells us more about what San Antonio looks like now in terms of the flood zones that exist as defined by FEMA, but that the San Antonio River Authority works actively in collaboration with FEMA to update and create new hydrologic and hydrological models that define where those floodplains are. And the question for San Antonio, from what I see in the data, is as San Antonio grows, as we continue to build and develop and densify and create more impervious cover or surface area that water cannot penetrate, the homes and structures that are within the floodplain are going to increase because that water runoff doesn't recede into the ground. So tools like the one that I built for the Rivard Report in our last flood article have to be constantly updated, which means that we need a consistent data ecosystem that our agencies are able to communicate and collaborate together to share data and information effectively to make sure that we're on top of those changes. Because San Antonio is growing really quickly, rapidly. In the next, by 2030, I think there's going to be another 30 million people moving to San Antonio. So we have, 1.5 million people. So we do have a huge growth that's occurring, and we need to figure out how to update our ecosystem in terms of data.
And people need to have access to that data to make important decisions on their own, updating their insurance and maybe preparing. Maybe they need to get a bass boat in the backyard just in case. We're going to continue our conversation. We invite the audience to jump in here. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980, getting ready for the big one in San Antonio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the possibility, the probability, eventual, this is going to happen. We're going to have a big flooding event here in San Antonio. What are we doing now to get ready individually, as a community, and with our governmental agencies? What's happening here? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. What are your thoughts? You must have tuned in to see the disaster of Harvey in Houston. That could have happened here, maybe not exactly at that, a duplicate, a clone of that, but something very similar and something very dangerous. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. Carlos is on the line. And Carlos, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, David. Thank you for taking my call. It's a great, great topic that we have this today. I just wanted to share my experience. I decided to buy flood insurance after Harvey, and primarily I did it because I read a story in Texas Monthly a couple of years ago about how political the flood maps from the Army Corps of Engineers could be. So I thought I'd play it safe, and even though my house isn't in a floodplain, I went ahead and bought the flood insurance. And I'll be honest with you, anybody who asks me about it, I definitely encourage people to err on the side of caution and get the flood insurance, even if they don't live in a floodplain.
All right, Carlos, I appreciate your call. Stephen Graham, Assistant General Manager for the San Antonio River Authority, do you have any advice?
Well, I highly endorse what Carlos is doing. Nationally, we know that 25% of all flooding occurs outside of the designated floodplain shown on maps. So there's a lot of uncertainty with those maps. We probably have some of the best floodplain maps in this community here, where we spent over $14 million to develop some of the best maps in the nation, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. I talked to a public works director from Fort Worth. He said in the urban parts of Fort Worth, almost 60% of the floodplains aren't mapped. In other words, water rushes down streets and through neighborhoods, and it jumps culverts, and it goes down your driveway. So you can get flooded even if you're not shown in the classic floodplain maps, which really just follow creeks and rivers. And we all know that flooding can come down streets. It can jump out of a drainage ditch. So the first line of defense is take care of yourself and your family with flood insurance. Yes, I totally agree.
Emily Royale, you're data director at the Rivard Report. You've looked at this data. You've put together maps. You've looked at them pretty closely. What does it tell you? I mean, do you see a lot of problems for residential areas?
Definitely. I think we see a lot of flood zones that are of varying degrees, according to FEMA. Zones that are identified either by extensive study of hydrological models or zones that, like Stephen said, are a little bit more uncertain. And if you take a look at the map that we built, you can also see where the city is choosing to invest in different drainage projects through the Capital Bond Improvements Program from 2012 and the one that was passed this year to kind of identify, you know, where and how maybe those floodplains might change as a result of the investment that the city is making.
Okay, here's another caller. This is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I want to say I was in the flood of 1998 down in Quiro and worked in flood recovery there. There were people that have been flooded three times that were not in a flood zone. Those flood zones were reworked. But now we're seeing more flooding and predicted greater amounts of rainfall and more frequent hurricanes. So I'm suggesting that perhaps it might be well to project some flood zones at what might be expected, not based on what has already occurred, because we have that information. The other thing is I'm concerned that the Railroad Commission is permitting drilling and storage of oil condensate and other hydrocarbons in flood zones. And that makes absolutely no sense to me. They don't take it into consideration when they permit. So I'd like the panel to discuss those two points, please.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you so much for the call. Nefi Garza at the City of San Antonio's Transportation Capital Improvements Department. Are y'all taking into account the prediction? Obviously, this is what's happening. Storms are getting bigger. They're getting wetter events. So we got to up our game.
We absolutely do, David. You know, I think it's important for us to understand that development and projects, it was mentioned earlier about the bond project, we design structures for the 100-year storm event, or better yet, the 1% chance. We require development in San Antonio to design not only to that, but to add a buffer to it, and we call it the 100-year ultimate. We make the assumption that everything upstream is fully developed without mitigation. So when we're doing our plans of our channels and our detention ponds and so forth, it is with that lens that we're looking at. But the trend now we're starting to see is that storms are happening and they're greater in magnitude. And that's a little worrisome to us.
Now, Manny Pelaez on City Council representing District 8. You guys have to make the tough calls on where to spend the limited amount of resources that the city has. In planning for storms in the future, you know, we have droughts. We go for months without rain, sometimes significant rain, and doing that while saying, "Well, we're going to get a bad flood," I mean, I could be really, and someone said, well, I want my taxes lower. I'd want, you know, this paved. I want to be able to develop without all these regulations. You guys are being pulled in all these different directions.
We are. And the definition of leadership at the end of the day is having to make tough decisions, despite the fact that you're going to make some people unhappy. And so I am absolutely certain that the developer community here in town probably hates that Neffy and his team require them to go above and beyond and pour more concrete and do more detention of water than they would like to. At the same time, I understand that there's a group of folks out here who think that every tax dollar spent is a waste of money. I'll remind you that, you know, the majority of our city budget is spent on resilience, right? And not just resilience to flooding, but resilience to crime rates, resilience to traffic, resilience to health issues. And so the role of government, before anything else, is to make sure that people don't die on our watch, right? And, you know, while it's certainly interesting to discuss things like Confederate statues and, you know, river barges and fiesta and all that, unless we're addressing that one basic core issue, which is if we don't do our jobs, people might perish, then we're malpracticing.
Well, that's the same thing I think about for a radio station like ours. I mean, when there are emergencies, we've got to be able to provide information and tell people what's happening, if there are evacuations, where to go. That's something we talk about all the time here. We have to prepare for those events, whether it be a terror attack, all these different things,
right,
will test the city's resilience.
So the key word is resilience, right? And so I think the most important thing is for everybody in this city, all the agencies, first responders, businesses, folks like you and TPR, that we all work off the same definition of resilience first, right? Because it's a word that is used quite often and nobody really knows what it means. And I think the standard accepted definition for those people who are experts in this is that resilience is when a community, individuals and groups and businesses can withstand acute shocks, right? Kicks to the gut, like these huge hailstorms or these, you know, hurricanes, and also be able to thrive despite chronic stressors like traffic, crime, increased heat, unemployment. And so we have to be ready on a whole bunch of fronts. And so I have very, very smart colleagues up on fourth floor. We've got very smart people working at Sarah and in Neffy's department and the police department. But too often resilience is siloed within different agencies and different departments. And so one of the things I'm working on and pushing really hard is for the city to look at resilience as one umbrella issue where we can bring everybody together and have one conversation about making sure that we've got interconnectivity and interoperability of systems, people, departments, and data.
One of those systems is our hospital capacity and what they are able to do with when we have these super emergencies. Do we know how our hospitals are situated when it comes to if we get a super storm? Stephen Graham, do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I do believe none of them are in the floodplain. I can tell you what a lot of communities are doing is they're identifying critical infrastructure, whether that be hospital, roads, schools. And because we've already talked about uncertainty and climate change with our existing known floodplains, this woman, her call spoke to that, I think it's important that we think about that. That could help us in being more resilient. So even though we think this is the 100-year ultimate floodplain, if it's a critical road that we need to get in and out of a community, maybe we add a foot or 2 foot. If it's a hospital, maybe it's 3 foot. That sort of buys down our risk. And I think that's a conversation occurring in most cities and the federal government is, do we start putting freeboard amounts on critical infrastructure that we need in these events? And that accounts for that uncertainty in climate change, which we really don't know about. We know that Harvey will change now, probably the 100-year flood that we designed for. That adds to the average that, you know, we've only been measuring rainfall for a little less than 200 years. And so who knows what the real 100-year is, especially with climate change. So I think this freeboard adding to criticality to the equation is imperative.
I don't know it doesn't do me any good to hear these 100-year, 200-year, 500-year flood type terms, because I'm talking about the flood that happened today when I'm up to my waist in water. Mm-hmm. And so why do we care about that?
Well, it is a very deceiving term. The 100-year flood does not mean it occurs every 100 years. It means every single year there's a 1% chance of that occurring.
Well, those seem to be happening a lot. So
correct.
What good is that term?
Well, it could mean that we need to start taking into account uncertainty and things that we aren't aware of. And so let's not treat the line on a map as a binary, you're safe or you're unsafe. This in-out business has got to go away. Everybody has risk, even if you're on a hilltop. And so I think we better need to communicate risk. And you're going to see from Sarah in October and November new products that we will be putting out called risk maps that start showing you how deep, how fast that water is. If you have a 30-year mortgage, what's your chance during that mortgage life of being hit by a flood? Now that will really start showing, painting the picture of you're not in and out. We all have risk. It's a matter of how much.
David, I want to add something to that because I think it's important that we frame this challenge. You see, the 100-year or the 1% chance, that is something that happened starting in 1971. That's when FEMA introduced that concept. Prior to that, that standard did not exist. So now imagine, if you will, the number of subdivisions and homes that were built prior to 1970. They did not have the standard that we have today. So part of the challenge is being able to construct infrastructure to protect those areas that are so vulnerable.
And how do you feel about that, Manny Pelias?
I have a problem with historical data, right? And every scientist will tell you, and every expert will tell you, historical data is really, really important. And Emily, I'm sure you agree, but you know, if you just look at what happened in Houston, their former head of the Harris County Flood Control District, who's no longer employed there, you know, when he was interviewed by the Texas Tribune, they asked him, hey, is there any kind of weather event that you're really scared of? And his answer is, not really. You know, we don't have any looming issues. And they said, well, what about bigger rain events? And he goes, well, you know, not really. Everything we use to, you know, plan is historical rainfall data. And by the way, we've got incredible drainage systems. And, you know, those are prophetic words that I'm sure he's regretting today. And like I said earlier, there's no more normal, right? And we need to start being forward thinking as opposed to backward looking, right? And so you're only as good as the last flood you responded to. And so one of the things that I'm working on is making sure to include everybody in this resilience conversation, including hospitals. I'll give you a nightmare scenario. Imagine if this flood had hit and it had hit our medical center. You know, and now you have a very big impediment to getting people to hospitals. What do you do then? Or more importantly, and as far as your data is concerned, Emily, you've got how many thousands of people in the city that because of lack of resources or physical inability, we can't evacuate on their own and would need our help. We really don't have those numbers. And that's the kind of data that we need, not just, you know, where the flood lines are and what the velocity of water is, which is incredibly important. But there's also so many others. I mean, think about this flirting with, you know, gas shortage hysteria that we went through. Nobody anticipated that. And that's kind of the thing that we're going to have to anticipate the next time, right?
Anticipate people having, you know, a freak out, mass freak out.
Yeah, and people are smart. And sometimes swarms are smart, but sometimes swarms are incredibly stupid, right? And
The mob. Yeah.
I think that's why it's really important to translate those data resources into tools that people can use. That's really critical. And in my process of creating this map and trying to find all of the data sources in different agencies that were needed to make this tool, I had to ask so many different people in spread across siloed agencies that clearly aren't talking to each other in order to create a holistic picture.
So we need to share data that's also part of the building resiliency. We're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break, talking about what if Harvey had come to San Antonio, how have we had fared with that flooding? What can we do in the future to make sure that we're ready? The number to call in if you got a question or a comment is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this quick break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about preparing for the possibility of extreme flooding coming to San Antonio in the future. That's one natural disaster that we have that will probably happen. We'll probably have a really bad flood. But what other disasters are looming out there? natural or man-made. We're talking about how San Antonio would respond to that also, and on top of the flooding. Give us a call if you got a question or comment. Number is 210-614-8980. We have an email from Craig. He has a question about retaining ponds and other types of structures. He's an engineer. He says, I understand that these structures are intended to simulate the natural landscape's ability to naturally slow the flow of water. As the city has grown, it has built roads, homes, large buildings, apartment complexes. It was my understanding that there are codes for the developers to create such structures that will help mitigate the flooding. So he wants to know, he sees these many structures that don't have anything like this. What happened? Why are some able to build these structures and others are not? So Manny Pelias.
You know, I struggle with this because earlier you mentioned that there's political consequences to, you know, telling developers, hey, you know, you've got a role in resilience and it's going to cost
low impact development strategies.
Yeah. And then, you know, that's the lid issue. And one of the things the city does is we do these things called fee in lieu of, right? Fees in lieu of having to build out some of this capacity to retain water. And, you know, you do too many of those. You got a serious problem, right? And I got to visit with the mayor of Leon Valley recently, and whether you agree with him or not, their position is that all these fee in lieu of scenarios and all this, you know, impermeable surface that we're building out has negative consequences on their little city. They've had to evacuate something like 47 families and chop down close to 1,000 heritage oak trees just to increase their amount of flood catch the amount of flood space that they can catch water with. I don't know what the answer is, and I leave that up to experts, which brings me back to the original point, which is this is a conversation that is very sophisticated. And, you know, the city has an equity officer. The city has an arts department. The city has, you know, a pre-K for San Antonio. But we don't have one place where resiliency lives. Other cities have resiliency officers. And that's one of the things I'm really pushing forward on. And I want there to be a resilience office.
So when you talk about resiliency, are we talking about if there's a major disaster that hits San Antonio, that the city is permanently diminished by the impact of that disaster? So we're going to see a population decrease or lost opportunities?
You're talking about is resiliency with a capital R, right? I'm talking about resilience with capital R and even resilience with lowercase r, right? So we need to be ready for any major kick in the gut that could have catastrophic consequences like that. And it could be anything, right? It could be a terrorist attack. It could be another flood. It could be a very, very long-term drought
at least let's plan for what's likely. I mean, we know it's likely we're going to get a major flooding event. I mean, you know, we just survived through the flip of a coin, Harvey coming through here. So we have to plan, you know, do some triage in that. And so, Stephen Graham, what is happening right now to make people feel like that as the assistant general manager for the San Antonio River Authority, that we are preparing? I mean, we know we've got a lot has been done and a lot is on the books.
Well, when I think about resiliency in terms of flooding, you know, it's really three major components. Of course, you're planning, you have to execute during an event and then post-event. But before an event, it's really about avoiding, minimizing, and mitigating. So how do I avoid flooding in the first place? So maybe not building in floodplains, creating and keeping green space that holds water. Low-impact development, LID, LID, also has an ability. While it focuses on water quality improvement, it does have some benefit to larger events as well. And then, of course, mitigating speaks to the capital projects, what government can do, but what individuals can do as well. And individuals are able to mitigate their own risks. So again, I think we have to have a whole spectrum of pre-storm planning. How do we make people aware? The councilman's correct. No one will be happy with whatever solution we come up with here. I would argue that the city of San Antonio has a very good drainage code, especially the last 20 years. It's comparable to any city in the U.S. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do more. And that's the yin and yang and the balance here is how do we do more that may cost more to develop, but yet is pro-development. And we don't apologize for saying these are our standards because we don't want to have to pay on the backside of an event. So getting our community behind the possibility of changing the way we develop is an important conversation as well.
I would like to add that I think we have to keep in mind that Bexar County plays a big role in this as well. And this September, right now, the $500 million Bexar County Flood Control Plan that was established in 2007 and identifies about 50 or so projects around San Antonio, drainage and flood control projects, expires. And, you know, looking at the commissioner's court meeting recently to review the ongoing funding of that plan, the consensus was what happened in Harvey is so big that what we have in place now may not be enough. And what we've already built costs so much money. How do we create resilient, Manny, strategies that may be more responsive in terms of low water crossings, evacuations, education, kind of hitting at this low-hanging fruit rather than building huge infrastructure that's expensive and clearly is not going to handle something like Harvey?
And Nefi Garza, we've got a new bond project that's just voted in recently, overwhelmingly, and there were a lot of projects to dealing with drainage there.
There certainly is, David. Thank you for bringing that up. I'll tell you that when you look at the bond list, you have to look at the drainage section, but also consider the street section, because when we build streets, we're taking care of some of the localized drainage network in there. I mean, if you look at from 2007 to up to this year that was approved, we're looking at $1.1 billion in street improvement, and we're looking at $500,000 worth of drainage improvement from 2007 until this recent bond. So we are going into improving our infrastructure, but just by doing so, that doesn't mean that we, the citizens, should just ignore storms that are happening, ignore low water crossings. Just before Tropical Storm Harvey was going to land, we had an incident on Pin Road where an individual decided to go into this low water crossing. It's things like that keep me up at night, really. Individuals that decide, look at water going over the road and say, you know what, I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to try it. Mm-hmm. Those are the areas that I struggle with.
All right, let me go to calls. This is Paul. And Paul, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. My question was for homeowners who are living in the Wilson Craig area. The flooding gets really heavy very quickly, and everyone there is required to have flooding insurance. However, I want to know, what can homeowners do to kind of deflect the water from creeping up in the front yard and eventually meeting the front door? Is there some kind of maybe damming system people can do on their own to help push water back themselves?
Okay, Paul, I appreciate it. I know exactly where you live in the Woodlawn Lake area, and that's where a lot of water goes into that. Stephen Graham over at the San Antonio River Authority.
Well, I'll take the first part, and Effie can add to this. But there's been significant investment by the city and the county upstream of the Woodlawn Lake area. In 2002, we saw it was very vulnerable to water rushing down from the Fredericksburg area up at 410 and going through that neighborhood. They've put in a series of major flood controls infrastructure known as Laddy Place that are significantly reducing the flood risk in those communities. Those maps are being reviewed. The updated maps are being reviewed right now. We're hoping by early next year, you'll see the map, the flood map floodplains coming down significantly, which reflect now that reduced risk because of these capital project investments by the city and the county.
And Nefi Garza?
For an individual homeowner, one of the things I always recommend is make sure you have positive drainage, that water is draining away from your home. If you do have areas where it's ponding, I always recommend vegetation. Put in some shrubs, put in a tree. Those kinds of things will absorb things. But Stephen is right. Steve, he's absolutely right. With the big flood control projects that are getting constructed in those areas will certainly help.
But if you know the flow of the water, and if it rains really heavily and it goes down the street into your house, I mean, could you build up a little burn or something to kind of redirect it into the next guy's house? Or how does that work, you know, Stephen?
You know, that's a real challenge. I think communities struggle with that. Remember, I said 25% of all flooding occurs outside of a floodplain. There's nothing that government can do in all cases. We're trying to fix roads to not do those things, but you always have uncertainty. Flood insurance, if you at all think you're having those situations, yes, do what you can, as Nefi described, with your property, but flood insurance is your best friend. It's fairly cheap. The average person pays about $800 a year. It's affordable when you consider the alternative.
And many Pilates.
Yeah, just parenthetically, I'll mention that your idea, David, of building up a berm and then diverting some of that water over to your neighbor's house, that'll get you sued real fast. And so please don't do that, folks. I'm a lawyer, and I can tell you that that's a bad idea. What is a good idea, however, is to listen very carefully to city officials when they tell you it's time to evacuate. What's a really good idea is to get insurance. You know, 85% of the people in Houston didn't have flood insurance. That is unacceptable, especially when we know that there is so much flooding that is going to happen. And whether you believe in climate change or not, there is no denying that we are seeing more and more of these big rain events and these hurricanes. And it's the smart thing to do to plan ahead. Right. And so if you're living in a flood zone, have a go bag. Right. Have a plan on when to go and don't wait until the water's already knee deep.
I mean, we knew several days in advance that looked like Harvey was coming here. People were rushing to HEB, buying up all the water.
Right.
What else should they have been doing? You know, making sure they had plenty of Ziploc bags and putting their valuables and things like that.
You know, and sometimes we as human beings want to stay in our cave and protect our turf, right, from in the face of hurricanes and all that. Nothing is more important. Nothing. Your TV, your car, your bikes, your sofa. Nothing is more important than your life, right? And so grab your kids, grab your pets, and run.
Okay. And hopefully, I mean, I'm sure we have plans in place to figure out where we can get people safely so they don't have to wait for the bass boat to come pick them up in the middle of the night because the water's rising. All right. We're going to continue the conversation, preparing for San Antonio for the disaster, hell or high water. We're going to do it. This is The Source continues. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Meetings today talking about disasters tomorrow could pay big dividends if we're thinking correctly, planning out what can we do now, figuring out where to evacuate now instead of waiting until the disaster is at our doorstep. That's what we're talking about this afternoon. How is San Antonio preparing for the big disaster of the future? You're invited into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. David has called in. And David, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. I look at Houston, and they've been building in the floodplains for years before this happened, and even a regular flood flooded many people. And building below the dam seems like a surefire way to have a flood in your home. I just wondered what we're doing to look at that in San Antonio. I have one comment for your last caller. My brother was in an area where the water was beginning to come close to his home, and he bought some irrigation pipe that's plastic that farmers use, and he put it around his house and filled it with water and kept the water from coming in.
All right. That sounds like a clever thing to do. Emily Royal over at the Rivard Report, you're the data director. Do you see that happening in San Antonio, or that we're building in places where we're not supposed to be building?
I mean, I'm not entirely qualified to say where we should and should not be building. But I do see that clearly from the maps that we've put together that the flood zones are aggravated, are larger, and growing on both the east and west sides of town. And notably, I think a lot of our investment that's been completed so far, I believe from the 2012 bond, we have 76% of our projects complete on the north side of town and 36% completed on the east and west and south side of town. So I think we need to take a look, listening to the public in terms of what their actual experiences are with floods, even small rainstorms that we experience. It doesn't have to be a 500-year flood to affect people's lives. I think finding ways to access those stories and those views and perspectives and experiences are really important for understanding where we need to invest.
So District 8 City Council Person Manny Pelaez, do you have any low water crossings in your district?
We do, right? But when we're elected city council people of San Antonio, I think it's responsible and it is leadership for us to look at the entirety of San Antonio. And so when we see a bond package come up and people say, you better get 1/10 of that bond package, you know, 1/10 should go to every district. I do push back and I say, well, listen, you know, less people are dying up here in District 8 than they are on the west and the east side. And less, you know, there's less property loss because of flooding. doesn't it make sense to send the flood dollars over to the west and the east side, and then we'll spend our dollars on sidewalks and other things? And there's a lot of people who get that, but this idea of rough proportionality, splitting of the budget in equal portions for each district, is something that doesn't work when you talk about big weather catastrophes like this.
Right. Right, but so there are parts of your district, you know your district really well. When you become a city council member, you know every block.
Yeah, sure. We do have low water crossings, and they're dangerous. And thankfully, our fire department up there on the north side of town and our police department immediately deploy, immediately, to those low water crossings
they
and block them off. Yeah, we know where they are.
Yeah.
And we do have a program, a Bexar County program called HALT, which is high technology. Anyway, it's a network of sensors at low water crossings that in some cases actually lower the gates so that people can't cross at all. So there is a really interesting program out there for automated low water crossings.
Well, and speaking of data for the general public, I'll make a shameless pitch. There is a website called bearflood.org. It was a application built by Bexar County, but it's supported by SARA and the city. You can actually download this onto your phone or mobile device, and it will show you all these low water crossings where the HALT devices are,
right,
where the city's devices are. You'll get a red, yellow, green to see if your route to work or back home is impaired because of rain. And that's a very important, and that's speaking to empowering people through data and applications. And so that's a great one that our city has.
Right. And looking at all the data sources that are out there and programs like that, we actively collect a massive amount of data from these programs. And the question really is getting agencies to share them and getting the public to be aware of it.
That's public information, though.
It is public information, but that doesn't mean it's easy to find.
All right. And HALT does stand for High Water Alert Life-Saving Technology. Renee has called in. Renee, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I live in the South End, and I can tell you a lot of those drainage projects do put a lot more water in the South End on us. And every year for the last 20 years, I've been seeing that water level go up and up and up. And it's getting to a point where even some of my neighbors have moved. And one of the things that I'm hoping that our policymakers will stop and consider doing, I should say, is city and county. I know that, like, if you look at French Creek and Whispering Creek, where they filled in areas, flood areas, that help retain water and allow developers to come in and build homes there, that doesn't help us. It just creates a velocity, makes the water go in faster, comes faster to us. Especially all those drainage projects, then, you know, if you don't get it and retain it at that site, then it's going to come to us. That's all I wanted to say, and I hope they change their policy and their approach.
All right, Renee, thank you for the call. So, Nefi Garza, when you hear a citizen like Renee talk about his experiences and observations, and yet it may run counter to what y'all expected the project was going to do, what do you do?
Well, I'll tell you, David, I mean, we see this often. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we're working on. This is what we're exploring, looking at how our infrastructure or how development is impacting our community. We look at that every day. That's what we do continuously. All our engineers that are working, we're trying to figure out.
What about reaching out to people like Renee and seeing, you know, tell us what your flood experiences are like? What are you seeing in your neighborhood? Are y'all able to have that sort of dialogue?
Absolutely. We welcome pictures, information from the public. That is the way we're going to be able to calibrate the information that we have. That's the way we're better able to design things if we're notified of these things. We have a great system called 311 where individuals can call. They provide information. We're able to go out there, investigate what is going on, and be able to come up with solutions, you know, short-term solutions on site, or if it's needed, some long-term solution that we can bring in Bexar County, we can bring in Corps of Engineers or the River Authority to help us with some of these larger events, larger
projects. Stephen Graham?
Well, David, I just want to point out that, yes, in general, rain, the water goes from north to south, but we can't treat drainage as we do political districts. You know, water flows through watersheds. And so I tell people all the time, the best drainage project for your neighborhood may be something north of you, where you hold that water back. So we can't be thinking about equal amounts
like
of money per
district. All these dams that are now in place.
Yeah, there's in San Antonio, there's 28 dams in northern
Like on Bexar Salado County. Creek?
Correct. And actually, Salado Creek's a great example. We have three times the holding capacity because of these far north side dams than all of Almost Dam combined. Three times, but you don't see it. So those investments, which were done in the 60s, 70s, and 80s on the far north side, are benefiting our east side and south side.
So Manipulayas, the city council, has voted to increase the stormwater utility fee for the upcoming budget. So what happened there?
Well, San Antonio is growing by about 156 people every day. Over the next 20 years, we're going to see 1.1 million people move here. We're going to turn into, just by using that math, the size of Chicago. That brings with it very serious drainage commitments and sewer water commitments and stormwater commitments. You know, every time we build a road, David, we're not just making a transportation commitment, we're making a drainage commitment, right? That water runs off of off that road. And so in order to get there and in order to continue making the investments that we're making in making sure people don't flood or get their homes get swept away, that costs money. And I understand some people hate that they have to pay more, but
I mean, people don't hate that they have to pay more. They just want to have confidence that the money is going to
correct.
Where it's supposed to go.
Absolutely.
So how do we know that the stormwater utility fee is going to somehow mitigate these floods?
Yeah, we know that without flood investment, right? In flood mitigation investment, we're not going to mitigate those funds, right? And so to the extent that I've got NEFI and I've got Sarah and I've got SAWS telling me this is absolutely necessary to our being able to continue making these investments, we have to trust the experts that we've brought on. And those experts, by the way, aren't just making this stuff up in a vacuum, right? Or just looking at San Antonio. These folks are looking at historic data, not just in San Antonio, but in other cities, right? And they're looking at benchmarking what other cities have done right. And I know for a fact that other cities are looking at San Antonio also to determine what it is that we're doing to improve their storm mitigation efforts. And so along those lines, I do want to challenge my friends at the city and the county and all the other first responder agencies and partner agencies that we need to be vulnerable to discussing our vulnerabilities, right? And we're not perfect. And I really welcome this conversation going forward, because in order for us to make sure that we're doing it right, this is going to have to be comprehensive across the board. And we're going to have a conversation about taxes. We're going to have a conversation about transportation, about healthcare, education, because all of those touch the issue of resiliency.
And David, allow me, if I may give you the stormwater utility fee. That money is used to maintain our current system. So we're not necessarily using that money to build new projects. It's to maintain the system, just like our vehicle. I mean, if you don't change the oil, if you don't change the tires of it, that life of that vehicle is only going to be so long. It's the same thing with our drainage infrastructure. I'm talking about our underground tunnels. I'm talking about our channels, mowing them, sweeping the streets, doing all of those things. There is a cost associated with that. And that's what the stormwater utility fee does. It maintains our infrastructure.
All right, and that infrastructure will be put to the test eventually when a storm like Harvey doesn't take a jog over to the right. Instead, it comes towards San Antonio and delivers a lot of rain, and we'll see how resilient San Antonio is as a city and as individuals, because we're all going to have to learn how to deal with that. I want to thank all of our guests, Manipulayas, San Antonio City Council Representative for District 8, NEFI Garza, Assistant Director of the City of San Antonio's Transportation and Capital Improvements Department. Stephen Graham is the Assistant General Manager for the San Antonio River Authority. Emily Royal joins us. She is the data director for the Rivard Report. I'm David Martin Davies. This is The Source. Thanks for tuning us in.